and welcome to Chapter 2 of this thesis entitled User-Generated Content for Design. My name is Alexandre Joyce, and I'm a student at the University of Montreal in the Design and Complexity Master's Program. In this chapter, we will dive deeper into the design research methods. The general objective of this chapter is to create a foundation of knowledge about design research to serve as a reference when analyzing the possible impact of user-generated creative content. To create this foundation, two building blocks need to be thoroughly established: the design process and the types of design outputs. The first half of this chapter focuses on the three elements that are present during the design process: users, products, and contexts. It is by studying the relationships amongst these three dimensions that needs and experiences are to be fulfilled and mapped out. This exercise orients the idea generation process by moving from the problem space to the solution space through the creative space. The second half of this chapter will distinguish different types of design outputs in order to investigate what part of our research can affect the design processes most pertinently. The three outputs that we have chosen to differentiate are products, services, and the middle ground of product-service systems. After defining each type of design output, we look to how they can manage the relationship between problem and solution spaces. Then, we approach each output in terms of innovative possibilities. This chapter concludes with a matrix that unites the information gathered in the first and second parts of this chapter. By confronting design research within the types of design outputs, we set the stage for analyzing the results of the collected content. Section 1. Design Research. Before we begin, it is important to reiterate the subtle differences in the expression design research. In fact, the addition of a conjunction to the expression orients the possible meanings. Research into design is the most widely spread as it refers to the other sciences like sociology or psychology studying the design process. In our present case, the meaning that applies is research for design, where knowledge is gathered with the intent of using it in the practice of designing. Finally, research through design, or research by design, studies the design process by actually undertaking a project. In such a case, complexity is an epistemology that can be applied to offer insights into the theoretical aspects of the act of designing. Research into the design process has produced results in describing the design process most proficiently in the 1980s under the name of design methodology. Many different researchers like Jones, Cahant, and Cross proposed their interpretations of the process. In the end, three dimensions are present in all interpretation: analysis, synthesis, and realization. In this research, we choose to follow Jones' terminology of divergence in the problem space and convergence in the solution space. This choice of terminology, when speaking of the design process, is established because of its similarity to Findeli's description of the complex design as an ongoing loop linking thinking and acting, as well as inspiration and expiration. This further promotes the idea that the design process is not a systematic step-by-step sequence of predetermined activities. In contrast, creativity works best when moving within all aspects of the problem and solution spaces. Any design method must permit both kinds of thought, both logical and creative, to coexist within the progress of the project. Continuing on Jones's proposal, we now focus on research for design, which happens at the beginning of the design process. Also known as design inquiry, the research for design we will study is concerned with identifying the problem space. We choose not to continue using the term design inquiry because of its mechanist and over-scientific connotation dating of the late 1970s. We would argue that the term design research, once cleared of all confusion, is more evocative of the direction taken in this design and complexity masters. How can we determine the problem space? Every problem-solving effort must begin with creating a representation for the problem. That is, a problem space from which the search for the solution can take place. Designers, with their global point of view, are called to create upon new concepts and new situations that don't necessarily fit any existing problem spaces. Therefore, the designer needs to find the right pieces before beginning to solve the puzzle. Research can provide deeper insight into the problem space as constraints are established and opportunities come to light. Research is more than searching haphazardly and more than solving problems pragmatically. The goal of research is to learn more about a situation in order to identify and solve new problems. When conducting research for design, We analyze the problem space by establishing the elements that characterize users, objects, and contexts. Then, we can begin studying the relationships between these entities. The following section will identify the differences in these elements, enabling us to apply them as filters when classifying the results of our field research. In true hologrammatic form, we are diving deeper into the design research poll illustrated in the first chapter, and yet we find ourselves studying the same relationships between subject, object, and environment. In this case, we're using a more precise terminology for design with users, objects, and context. So what are these three founding dimensions in design research? The construction of the problem space can be carried out by studying the three poles individually, each one within the realm of unique scientific fields. For example, studying users from a psychological point of view could reveal their primary needs in terms of security and comfort. Again, the users could be evaluated in sociological terms to determine the importance of social status or hierarchy within that user group. On the other hand, objects are often studied using tools of hard sciences like physics and chemistry. Lastly, cultural studies and history are just two examples of the many fields that can provide insights into the context of a problem space. Consequently, studying the three poles individually, from the standpoint of individual sciences, produces results that remain unidimensional and lack a comprehensive understanding of the problem space. This explains why complexity in research for design is much more interested in the relationships amongst these dimensions. So what are the relationships amongst these dimensions? If individually the three founding dimensions remain static and show little promise for generating new ideas, the interfaces between these dimensions are of higher relevance to the design research, because they can lead to defining needs. Also, these gray areas are more open to interpretation and can result in new understandings of the problem space. So, to determine the elements to be studied in each interface space, we reviewed multiple writings on user needs analysis. What follows are the most relevant elements. However, the message we wish to make clear is that although the following keywords will direct our research focus, we are fully aware that many more elements could be put under the microscope. Thus, the following elements within these interfaces were deemed most relevant to investigating user-generated creative content. The first relationship we wish to look at is that of users and objects. So when studying users' relationship with products, behaviors and interactions are closely related to the design. These actions can be studied by looking at triggers, endpoints, standard steps, decision points, and exceptions. Triggers are the cause for an action to start. Triggers make the user want to begin a task. Endpoints are the cause for the action to end. Endpoints help the user acknowledge that the task is complete. Standard steps refers to the process to accomplish the action. Decision points are the forks in the road. These are the moments of hesitation which can reveal inadequate information or a lack of continuity in the process. Exceptions are the uncommon or original steps that users take. They reveal marginal circumstances and usually require a higher degree of adaptation. Contexts and users. The relationship between users and contexts can be compared to that of a fish unaware of living in water. The context is so omnipresent that it can be overlooked. Nonetheless, by studying such elements as culture, we will expose the mindset in which people operate. Also, we will take into account values as they shed light on the reasoning behind certain attitudes, hierarchical power as it reveals the decision autonomy of the users, emotions as they express the user's reaction to the context, and style as it divulges the identity that users wish to portray within the context. Thirdly, we have the relationships between objects and contexts. By taking the users out of the equation, we are left with the mostly technical and quantitative relationship between context and objects. This interface is concerned with the characteristics that are present in objects in order to perform under precise circumstances. The needs that will come from examining this relationship consists of criteria such as standards. Norms are an example of these constraints that need to be respected. Layouts demonstrate the place of objects within a space. The definition of space and movement is highly characterized by the underlying structures that support them. Because of the working outputs they provide, tools are considered as contextually relevant objects. Lastly, we have context, objects, and users. The combination of the relationships between users, object, and context can be summed up in the concept of the experience. Merleau-Ponty provides considerable insights into seeing the object as an experience. He compares the experience to an echo of consciousness or a unison between the body and the object. It can be perceived continuously within the context of space and time. He emphasizes the multidimensional aspects of the experience as well as the interaction between the dimensions. The experience touches the entirety of the being as part of the absolute reality. Objects do not exist on their own. We perceive the experience of the object as a subjective essence that transpires from the use scenario. Some go even as far as saying the experience is the object. Within the greater concept of experience, there are some elements that can implicate all three dimensions of the problem space. Movement is one part of the experience flow. It reveals how users manipulate objects within the context. Communication is the equivalent of movement and transactions in terms of information. Strategy is the contextual reasoning that manages users' intent. Informal structures are the aspects that subconsciously work around the norms, or even the strategies. Merleau-Ponty states that knowledge comes from the experience of a phenomenon and not an in-depth empirical or intellectual study of the characteristics of its components. This coincides with the way we accorded more importance to the relationships between the elements in the problem space rather than to the individual poles. This emphasis on the relationships that define a complex approach is actually a stepping stone towards entering the solution space. So how can the problem space lead to the solution space? The research that goes into formulating the problem space leads to designing a preferred situation in the solution space. A good understanding of the problem space creates opportunities for generating new concept. In the chapter called Starting from Scratch, Treating the New in Terms of the Old, Sean tries to explain where novelty comes from. He tries to answer the question of how we can deal with the new in terms of the old, but without reducing it to the old. He starts by stating that when working towards the new, all we can use is the old. This can be seen as a form of unintelligence, thus leading to dealing with novelty by ignoring the old. Due to the figurative and approximate nature of humans, analogy is what separates us from the literal and exact. Sean therefore develops on three ways of treating the new in terms of the old: comparison, error, and concept instances. All can lead to novelty, but aren't necessarily generating new concepts. Comparison is an evaluative method of distinguishing common characteristics amongst two or more things. Although this doesn't lead to new concepts, this allows to seeing two things together by juxtaposition. Error is treating two things as similar when they are in fact different. This is reducing the new to the old. Concept instance is a simple method of recognizing an element by its characteristics. It is a form of sifting out the new to recognize the old. So how are new concepts created from the old? New concepts arrive as a result of this shift, which happens after the process of this displacement. Sean calls this a displacement of concept, describing it as a metaphor of the extension of the concept of old. In Chapter 4, we will expand on this concept while exemplifying it with other elements from the field research. Tying into another of Sean's theories on idea generation in reflection and action, Coyne and Snodgrass demonstrate how the design process is similar to a contextual and dialogical understanding of a conversation. This concept will also be further discussed in Chapter 5 when looking at the consequences of this research. For now, we wish to state that the objective of a conversation-like activity is that both parties expand from their initial understanding. This to-and-fro movement from the first point of view to that of the third-person point of view leads to displacement of concepts. In conclusion, the design research section is comprised of two parts. Firstly, the design process moves back and forth from problem, creative, and solution spaces. Secondly, research for design implies studying the relationships between users, objects, and contexts in order to reveal the underlying needs of the situation. By capturing the state of the design situation in these terms, we are actually providing entry points into the solution space because ideas are generated by displacement of concepts. Now that we have described how design research can lead to generating ideas, we wish to explore what types of design outputs require these creative inputs. Section 2, Design Outputs. The following section of this chapter establishes the characteristics of three types of design outputs. Products, services, and product service systems are in fact three possible outputs of the design process. Because of the focus of this research on the initial phase of the research for design, we choose to approach each type of design output on three different levels. In an effort to create a common understanding of the various design outputs, we turn to the processes that create these outputs. To do so, we begin by defining them. We then move on to the methods with which each type of design process formulates the problem and move towards finding solutions to cater to the design situation. Finally, we look into how innovation applies to each output. How can we define product design? The design activity itself has been defined by Simon when he stated that everyone designs who devises courses of action aimed at changing existing situations into preferred ones. Defining design has often been a difficult task because it is comprised of many intangible elements such as intuition, imagination, and creativity. Moreover, the process of design is a difficult undertaking because it deals with and even manages these intangible elements, such as ambiguity and uncertainty. All these intangibles can be seen as barriers to scientific epistemologies, but including heuristics enables design to confront and ultimately to shape the reality of everyday life. Product design is therefore the design activity that consists of creating material goods in order to answer the needs of users. The process begins by gathering information about the user's needs, the object's requirements, and the context constraints of the design situation. By inventively remixing together ideas, drawings, and information, the product design process repeats cycles of problem-solving efforts. This leads to a progression in transforming the input information into the output design. The design evolves in a process that is stepwise, iterative, and recursive, where each step achieves a measure of progress on a proportion of the problem, and it is becoming a proposed solution. The process formally ends when the production of the solution is complete. What are some product design methods? The earlier approach in the design process was object-oriented. Technological and scientific knowledge necessary to manufacturing products was itself under development, and objects were designed to accomplish a function. Now that we have attained a certain mastery in the production and marketing of goods, the paradigm has shifted its focus towards user-centered design, a term first proposed by Norman when he argued for redefining the goal of product design to first and foremost cater to the needs of users. Turning user-centered ideals into physical products that can be engineered and produced is not an easy task. Again, we choose to narrow the scope of how users' needs can become ideas for design. In-depth understanding of everyday user practices leads to an overwhelming amount of immensely detailed information. This is why we established a few key elements to further focus on our efforts in defining the problem space. Because Zeisel focused on the same initial aspect of the design process, we choose to restate the five characteristics of the design method as he puts them forth. Number one, the three elementary activities. The complex activity called designing interconnects three constituent activities, that is, imaging, presenting, and testing. Number two, there are two types of information. Information used in designing tends to be useful in two ways, a heuristic catalyst for imaging and as a body of knowledge for testing. Number three, shifting visions of a final product. Designers continually modify predictions about their final result in response to new information and insight. The design process is thus a series of conceptual shifts or creative leaps. Number four, toward a domain of acceptable responses. Designers aim to reach one acceptable response within a range of possible solutions. This domain of acceptance is measured largely by how well a product is adapted to its environment and how constituent parts of the products interact with one another. Number five, development through linked cycles, a spiral metaphor. Conceptual shifts in product development and design occurs as the result of repeated iterative movement through the three elementary design activities. The methods developed to design products are closely linked to the design process described previously in the analysis, synthesis, and realization models. However, the particular case of product design is concerned with solving problems that are related to the production of better physical goods to respond to the needs of its users. And now, how to innovate in product design. Innovation is often thought as an epiphany, when in fact, that eureka-like moment is more akin to placing the last piece of the puzzle and finally getting a total picture for the first time. Closer to reality is that innovation requires a lot of research in the initial phases. It is amassing the pieces of the puzzle and placing them on the table to begin creating the meaning. Once more, This resembles the process that we have described in going from the problem to the solution space. The gap between the two spaces is where innovation begins with ideas. It is by framing the problem differently that innovative ideas come about. Take Edison, for example. He wasn't alone to search for lighting solutions, but he was the first to think in terms of a system that could get electricity to homes, which would be used for lighting. Innovation is therefore a combination of seeing the problem clearly and having the talent to solve it. In the end, innovation is most clearly recognized when the idea becomes accepted, not only by those proposing it, but by the population of users in general. To get this idea accepted is what constitutes the main barrier to innovation. Product design has been part of the Industrial Revolution at the heart of the material economy of the 20th century. The core of any goods manufacturer has always been the introduction of new products or product improvements, also referred to as innovations, without which the manufacturer will ultimately go out of business. The innovative products must satisfy potential customers and respond to the pressures of competition, whether local or foreign. This has been a tiresome pursuit that very few manufacturers have been able to maintain over a long period of time. As we witness the delocalization of the production phase to rapidly developing countries in emerging economies, our reflex has been to increase specialization and other steps within the industrial process to ensure the survival of our own economy. A tentative solution taking root in our society has been to turn our attention to providing services. The second design output is designing services. As developing countries are responding to the world's agrarian and manufacturing needs, the developed countries are moving towards an information-based economy. Services have come to represent more than 75% of the US and UK economies, a growing 69% in the Indian economy, and the interest for the field is ever increasing. But what exactly is a service? How can we define services design? From a marketing perspective, Kotler defines a service as any activity or benefit that one party can give to another that is essentially intangible and does not result in the ownership of anything. This definition is somewhat acceptable, but remains a bit ambiguous because of the result, which is characterized as essentially intangible. Hollins describes service design as both tangible and intangible. It can involve artifacts and other things, including communication, environment, and behaviors. Whichever form it takes, it must be consistent, easy to use, and strategically applied. This leads us to thinking of services in holistic terms. It is by thinking in terms of systems, infrastructures, relationships, or interactions that the customer's experience is designed holistically. This can be seen as a cornerstone of service design. Approach to designing services is a natural evolution following the change in the design problem-solving paradigm that emphasizes user-centered design. By looking at the needs of the users and opportunities of the market, service providers strive to achieve a fixed end result. Because of this focused objective that services cater to, the design of products within the service differs. For example, a service relieves the user from the responsibility of the end of life of the product. Therefore, the user's relationship to the product is less about owning and more about usage. Inversely, the user's relationship with the company is greatly impacted by the overall experience in achieving the provided benefit. What are some service design methods? When creating a new service, determining the problem space largely concentrates on understanding users' needs. Answering this need is at the core of the service, without which the service has no meaning. Papanek was an early figure in thinking how designing services can cater to users' needs. In fact, he believes that underlying needs have often been overstaged by the satisfaction of ephemeral wants and desires. Moreover, Papanek describes an extensive difference between designing for needs and for wants. The economic, psychological, spiritual, social, technological, and intellectual needs of human beings are usually more difficult and less profitable to satisfy than carefully engineered and manipulated wants inculcated by fad or fashion. On the other hand, Holland relates that some marketers quantify the importance of wants and needs when designing a service. They establish needs as four times more important than a want. But Hollins isn't endorsing this qualification or quantification because it can lead to specifying false requirements. In his view, answering a need is essential to the adoption of a service, whereas if a want is not part of a service, the user can still achieve the expected outcome. Having a service or a product respond to its users' needs is not an easy task. The overwhelming cause of failure in product and services launches is due to the companies do not understand the customer's requirements. Lack of market research is also part of the problem. The fact that 2 out of 3 products and services put on the market are failures shows that designers aren't answering people's needs. This hides a larger problem in design management where too little emphasis is put on the initial research phase. In addition, the market research and problem-setting phase of design process may take for only 12% of the expenses in developing a new product or service. Injecting a little more time and money in these phases could result in identifying potential failures by better discerning needs and therefore increasing the potential for the success of the design. Moving more resources to design specification phases seems to be a simple solution, but there are 2 reasons for which this hasn't taken place so far. Firstly, most companies haven't taken the time to analyze the cost of each phase of development. This is partly due to the fact that the separation of various departments hides the true global picture. Secondly, and more importantly, assumptions made by administrators are often at the base of the concept stage, not reliable research findings. Furthermore, design firms are rarely allowed to question the brief that is provided. This limits the designer into a solution-finding process, which reduces the overall opportunity for innovation and creating value for the client and the user. In summary, services are focused on answering the user's needs, and this is fittingly reflected in the service design process. It emphasizes researching the user's needs and identifying the problem setting more than simply developing a solution to a predetermined problem. What is innovation when designing services? Holland continues to discuss how innovation is integrating the services sector. Innovation, being an important subset of the design process, is poorly applied in the service sector. Innovation can occur in all stages of the whole life of the product, especially and increasingly at the service end, when customers are more likely to be directly involved with the delivery of the service. The idea of having customers more involved in the services they require is increasing in strength. This has led to participatory design methods being applied to better focus on the customer's point of view. Therefore, service designers will need a shift of attitude. They will have to design with rather than for people. This idea was put forth by Papanek, who, again, was early to acknowledge that designers have not to design for money, but to design for many. Innovation is generally easier to achieve with services as there are less of an existing infrastructure to be replaced than with manufacturing. Customers more readily accept changes brought about through innovation. When designing innovative services, there are few strategies that can be adopted. For example, by measuring performances, the service provider can better answer the customer's expectations. Also, using mystery shoppers can ensure that service standards are maintained and continually improved. Designing a service where customers can see a clear benefit in using it has also measurable benefits for the organization. Maximizing all types of resources enables the organization to do more with less. Although the customer isn't always aware of this practice, it can be a part of the strategy to inform the customer of the lower impacts on the environment. This leads to educating customers, which might be time-consuming, but often fundamental part of the service design process. How can we differentiate services from products? Before moving to the space between services and products, we choose to establish the differences between the two. The IHIP framework, standing for inseparability, heterogeneity, intangibility, and perishability, dates back to 1978 and is the classic articulation of what differentiates services from goods. This was the basis for the later differentiation proposed by Hollins to understand the distinctions between service design and product design. He presents 5 ways in which most services differ from manufactured products. Firstly, customer contact. Generally, the customer is probably unaware of how a product was manufactured. In the case of services, production and consumption tend to occur at the same time. Also, some services cater directly to their customers, while others respond to other businesses. Although each product produced can be identical, the experience of interacting with a service is always going to be different from one customer to another. Quality. Some aspects of manufactured products can be measured objectively. In contrast, the overall quality of the service is much more subjective. In a service, there are a few quantitative measures as the evaluations tend to be mostly qualitative. As a result, there is a wider variability in the services and it is more difficult to control the quality of a service. Storability. Because services tend to be intangible, it is usually impossible to store them. For example, a car in a showroom, if not sold today, can be sold tomorrow, but an empty seat on an airplane loses its value once the plane has left. You can count how many products you have on hand, yet you can't take inventory of a service. Tangibility. One can physically touch a manufactured product, but most services are intangible. One cannot touch legal advice or a journey, though one can often see the results. You can see and touch a product before you buy it, yet you can't feel a service until you experience it. Transportability. Most services cannot be transported and therefore exported, though the means of producing these services often can. It is estimated that only 11% of services are exportable, although this is fast changing. Unlike a product which can be taken home after purchase and used later, services are consumed in the same time and place where they are purchased. To summarize, as the economy relies on the services sector, the design of innovative services is growing in importance. Now, we are seeing the rise of some new approaches like product service systems that adapts existing design methodologies to joining both types of design outputs in a sense of a middle ground. Section 3. Product service systems. How can we define product service systems? In a 2007 paper retracing the evolution and the present understanding of product service systems, Baines et al. Have reviewed the past decade of literature on the subject of PSS design and established the state of the art of this growing field. The authors proceed to examine many definitions of all the nomenclature that relates to the field. In some cases, they show the variability in the definitions, thereby demonstrating the evolution of the concept over time. For example, the initial author treating directly PSS and naming it so was Mark Giotkoop, who defined PSS as: a product service system is a system of products, services, networks of players, and supporting an infrastructure that continuously strives to be competitive, to satisfy customer needs, and to have a lower environmental impact than traditional business models. This differs slightly from the definition of Enzio Manzini, who picked up on the trail and popularized the notion of PSS in 2003. He defined it as an innovation strategy, shifting the business focus from designing and selling physical products only to designing and selling a system of products and services which are jointly capable of fulfilling a specific client's demand. Manzini is the author that speaks most of the possibilities for sustainability emerging from such a process. Ironically, the mention of environmental impacts is not mentioned in the way it is in Gudop's initial definition. By studying other definitions of the sort, Baines et al. Have noticed the adoption of Giotkoop's definition through the literature. Nonetheless, Baines et al. Do dare to propose this simplified definition of a PSS. A PSS is an integrated product and service offering that delivers value in its use. In this paper, we choose to follow the general consensus and continue with the definition that Giotkoop established. It is noteworthy to determine at this time the meaning that he attributed to the words product service system in his definition. Hence, a product is a tangible commodity manufactured to be sold and to fulfill a user's needs, whereas a service is an activity done for others with an economic value. And lastly, a system is a collection of elements including their relations. Some PSS projects are creating new business markets because of their emphasis on selling the use rather than selling the product. There has been mention of companies adopting one of the three types of PSS. The product-oriented PSS promotes and sells a product in traditional manner. This includes the original act of sale and additional services such as after-sale services guaranteeing functionality and durability of the product owned by the customer. For example, a computer with an extended servicing. The use-oriented PSS, that is to sell the use or availability of a product that is not owned by the customer. For example, a car-sharing service. And lastly, there's the result-oriented PSS, where selling a result or a capability instead of a product, for example, a laundry service. The result-oriented PSS model is more complex, yet nonetheless represents the most popular and innovative interpretation of the features of the PSS. Although a result-oriented model better suits the customer needs by allowing the provider to customize their response, consequently increasing the quality of their service and creating differentiation with competing companies. In looking to create a total value for the customer, the experience is designed and tailored to his needs. It must also take into account the culture in which the PSS will operate. All this leads to a PSS development process that is subject to a case-by-case basis and viewed from the client's perspective. The creation of product service systems has influenced industrial designers to start thinking in terms of services more than in terms of products. In a small editorial piece for the Journal of Industry of Ecology, LifeSet takes on this new mindset as a sustainable practice and warns of four possible downfalls. Firstly, confusion between the matters of ownership and actual physical use can arise. The characteristics of the object don't necessarily change because it is new use strategy. Cars in a community leasing program remain the same carbon dioxide gas emitters. This new use-oriented strategy also leads to a second possible result. It has been acknowledged by life cycle analysis researchers that most of the impacts of an object is created during its use. In this case, multiple users share an object and therefore increase its use percentage drastically. The quick answer to these two drawbacks can come from the simple decrease in the amounts of produced objects. Increasing the number of users for one single product can reduce the demand for a single large-scale production. Secondly, the company that manages the service will be in charge of taking care and taking back the product. It is also to their advantage to create longer-lasting products that can be easily disassembled for recycling or reusing within the next generation of products. The third downside is that marketers have been selling products with multiple functions, in what has been called bundles. Marketers have been targeting the consumer's wants and responding with tailored features on those products, whereas an ecological design of the product might go against part of these customer demands. Finally, products are more than physical service providers. They can have social functions too. A car is much more a status symbol than it is as a way to get from A to B. This is a negative aspect that needs to be addressed in the social collective. If the design team behind the PSS has done its job right, these two previous arguments could be a thing of the past, as users begin following the spirit of you are what you do and not what you own. The bundle aspect of a product can still be present in the family of services offered by the company. The social symbols can be definitely a part of the services as well. In stride with this kind of thinking, Findeli and Buzbaki go one step further by proposing that design should think in terms of actors and their life cycles by eclipsing the functions of an object. What are some of the PSS methods? Generally speaking, Morelli's article presents the theoretical foundation for the present methodologies to design product service systems. Morelli decided to explore an argument for these three aspects of the process: analysis of the system as a social construction, management of the process of a PSS through the various phases, and a technical representation of the PSS in the design process. However, we choose to revisit these three subjects with simplified titles. The social aspect of systems. In focusing on Morelli's first point, an analysis of the system as a social construction needs to be undertaken to assure a better link between the culture of the users and the implementation of the network technology. He proposes a method developed by Bischker to evaluate the social setting with a certain set of predetermined criteria. Depending on the general profile that arises, this analysis would help better enhance or limit the implementation of the service. Even though some services might entail a substantial learning curve for a certain part of the population profile, if the design is well thought out and the advantages are clearly stated, people can embrace change. Scenario building. A scenario, the imagined story of an event, is itself a design. A story illustrates an event that can be understood by most people. Because of their narrative aspect, stories can have an effect in communicating experiences and activities in context to people with different backgrounds. Scenarios have been used for various purposes in the design process, such as problem description, future prediction, concept generation, requirement analysis, and detailed system design. Scenario building illustrates and identifies requirements for generating solutions that address needs discovered in a certain context. To address these needs, the scenario method generates a holistic representation to identify problems and requirements from multiple points of view and incorporates them into a description of a solution. In the end, scenarios are images of possible, probable, or preferable futures, or futures to be avoided, and sometimes comprise the steps to achieve them. Generally, scenarios are to be developed and used in normative or exploratory manner. Normative scenarios greatly resemble the creation of visions for the future. Often, only few normative scenarios are developed, and the main purpose is to identify the perfect future of a given subject. The scenarios may then be used as a tool to identify actions that must be taken by different users if the visions for the future are to be realized. This method is almost often used by organizations that have a clear agenda and set of goals that they wish to pursue without too much debate on uncertainties of the future. In this sense, the normative scenario becomes an established process description. In the following chapter, we will therefore focus on the creation of exploratory scenarios, which are concerned with the presenting of the uncertainties of the future. They are created in order to understand just how different the future service may be and what may spark these changes. Still, existing scenario building approaches do not use consistent methods for accommodating and manipulating multiple aspects of a use situation. Blueprinting. A service blueprint is an operational tool that describes a service in enough detail to implement and maintain it. The blueprinting method is used by designers, business managers, and software engineers during the development. It represents a potential process, and then works as a guide for managers who operate the service on a day-to-day basis. Designers use blueprinting to ensure that the service is centered on the customer's experience. All tangible manifestation and hidden processes defined in the blueprint are thought out in terms of user experience. Therefore, blueprints build on use cases or customer journeys throughout the service design. Lynn Shustak was the first to write about visually describing a service. She revealed that unsystematic design and control methods lie at the root of service failures. As a result, service development is usually characterized by trial and error rather than by deliberate methods like service blueprinting. The basic need for service blueprinting is threefold. Firstly, because processes take place in time, a blueprint must, like PERT charting, show time dimensions in a diagrammatic form. Secondly, and more commonly, similar to engineering processes, a blueprint must identify all main functions and subfunctions of the service. Where these are performed by people, a work chart should be constructed. All input and output of functions must be shown. Akin to systems design, the blueprint must precisely define tolerance of the model. For example, the degree of variation from the blueprint standard that can be allowed in execution without affecting the overall quality. The graphical representation of a PSS is the topic of an ongoing debate, with several interesting contributions, but as with scenario building, no final definition of a standard for blueprinting in PSS exists. More on these relationships could be known if the literature presented more critical and in-depth evaluation of their performance in practice. Baines and others have determined that the range of tools and methodologies that are present in developing a PSS are often subtle modifications of more conventional design processes and lack the completeness of the set of tools proposed. They wish to pursue their understanding of PSS by developing more tools to create PSS strategies that study further what is called the management of transition, and thus use more quantitative methods. However, the challenge to integrate the relevant stakeholders in the participatory process remains. In contrast, our goal is to show that users are already participating, and figure out how designers can translate that in a more effective PSS. What are the innovation strategies in PSS? A product service system is also a new strategy for businesses to change the role of manufacturing operations in developed countries of the Western world. From their point of view, the solution to a reduced amount of objects produced lies in augmenting the intensity of the knowledge required to produce such products. When a manufacturer becomes more responsible for its products and services through take-back, recycling, or even upcycling, then refurbishment, the integration of a PSS strategy reduces waste throughout the product's life. That is the argument upon which authors base themselves to describe PSS as a sustainable strategy. In fact, the sustainability of the PSS becomes possible thanks to a systems view in the development and the maintenance processes. Because of this worldview on the situation, designers are empowered to better manage the waste and quality of the output of the PSS produced. This same perspective not only allows for better environmental impact management, but also reduces the economical costs of rendering the service. Interestingly, the majority of authors that expose the results of designing a PSS prefer emphasizing the benefits on an environmental and social scale over demonstrating the economical successes. The designer's tendency towards leaving aside the economical cost variation of running a PSS might be due to the cultural barrier required to embrace such a shift in operating methods. This shift and new understanding has to take place not only in the minds of the company executives, but also in the minds and hearts of the customers. So far, an initial resistance to ownerless consumption has been manifested by users. Furthermore, if users have to relinquish their ownership of an object, companies have to become responsible for structuring their organization to receive the used products. Companies also take on the risk of product malfunction. This is not to mention the difficulty in pricing a single use for a product. For example, what should be the cost of printing one sheet of paper? To surmount the barriers that stand in the way of adopting a PSS as a service, as a business strategy, a company must learn to work with a complex point of view and therefore develop a systemic approach to designing their services. This complex point of view also suggests including all players into the equation, as mentioned by Griot-Koop's original definition. Therefore, the users have a pivotal role to play in participating in the early development stages to create a system that is conscious of the user's perspective of the service offered. Some researchers go one step further by stating that an effective PSS users should be thought as innovators, emphasizing a shift towards co-creation whereby end users play an organized role in the design process. Therefore, this change comes from thinking in terms of products to thinking in terms of systems. And this modifies the relationships between businesses, users, and designers. So how can we conclude on design research and outputs? This part of our research has led us to better understand the design process, particularly the initial phase of research for design. We have seen that the problem space is constituted of users, objects, and contexts, and that the relationship amongst these three dimensions reveal needs and opportunities to be taken into account. By formulating the problem space in this way, we are also simultaneously moving within the solution space by generating ideas in concept shifting. Furthermore, the importance of understanding users' needs and their point of view are recurring themes in theory and in practice. The design activity is centered upon the user's global experience. Therefore, this research will look to see how the founding theories in moving from the problem space to the solution space can be applied in terms of product design, services design, and PSS design. Now that we have created a matrix to study design research and three different design outputs, the question is, how will we gather and study the information that users are providing over the internet? The answer will come in our next chapter in the form of a protocol inscribed in participatory design methodology. Thanks for listening to chapter 2 of this thesis called User-Generated Content for Design. My name is Alexandre Joyce, wishing you all the best.